to share what's going on, and hopefully we're going to have a great outcome.
Yes.
Hey, Linda. Okay, Linda, closing words for my wonderful Linda.
Thank you for including me in this show, Freemanek. And thank you, all the listeners and our audience out there. I always appreciate you.
Yes, we do. I appreciate you too, Linda. Okay, we'll be back next week also on Juneteenth Radio. I think we're going to delve into Christmas and or Kwanzaa. Or Christmas. Yes, indeed. Now, Mike, tell me when you get that text. I hope you get it, my man.
Yep, I got it.
That's our super producer. There's a song about a house. We're going to get out of here. Back next week. Freemanek Radio, KBOO. Keep listening. Thank you, Mike. I'm out.
I'm Karen James from Prison Pipeline. On December 21st, we'll broadcast your holiday messages to and from your loved ones in prison. Write your holiday message or record your voice using Zoom and email your message to kbooppc@gmail.com. Then tune in to Prison Pipeline on December 21st to hear your holiday messages to your loved one. Again, send those written or recorded messages to kbooppc@gmail.com. And from all of us at Prison Pipeline, stay safe, be well, and all the best during this holiday season.
You are listening to KBOO, Portland. Now stay tuned for Fortress on a Hill.
Welcome to Fortress on a Hill. I'm Henry.
I'm Danny.
I'm Kagan.
We're three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and to illuminate the damage military service does to America.
American presidents throughout U.S. history have used American military and diplomatic power to force regime change of democratically elected governments around the world.
Most veterans come from families vested in prior service, and American generals choose their own, ensuring diversity of thought never interferes with American warmongering.
How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists, when nothing could be more false?
Fortress on a Hill aims to change that.
Welcome back, listeners, to Fortress on a Hill. We are keeping going. Biden has been elected, it seems, right? Well, he's been elected. Looks like he'll be president, theoretically. And wouldn't you know that the problems have not yet been solved, but give it a month. I'm sure they will. But obviously, we've got a thousand more things to talk about. And as even the folks who we talk so much about on that, you know, Joe Biden Foreign Policy Record episode right before the election that, you know, everyone loved and we didn't get any pushback on, none at all, I promise. You know, we talked so much during that episode about, hey, regardless of where you fall on that, I think it was pretty clear where we did ultimately fall. People like, you know, Noam Chomsky and Cornel West and these key, you know, stalwarts of like the progressive movement and sort of anti-militarism, where they fell, which is, hey, like, let's get this guy in office who we can maybe work a little bit more around the margins with, and then don't take your foot off the gas pedal. And no one's ever accused us here of doing that. So we've got a lot more to talk about and a lot more guests, and we've been on an incredible run for really about a year, and it's no different today. Our guest today is Dr. Ben Freeman, who is a colleague and really, you know, sort of becoming a friend and just collaborator, commiserator over at the Center for International Policy. He is the director of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative over there. And there's a lot of stuff cooking at CIP that we'll talk about, you know, a new blog, the Barraza, just so many reports. And the stuff that Ben is working on and the stuff that's being worked on across the all the different initiatives and programs over there have been incredibly timely with what's going on. So basic bio stuff. Ben is, like I said, the director of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative. What does he do there? Well, in general, he works to expose how foreign governments are influencing U.S. public policy and elections, building upon, you know, his book, The Foreign Policy Auction, which we'll link to, really one of the first books to systematically analyze the foreign influence industry in the U.S. And I don't think that gets enough attention, particularly in the mainstream, and particularly if it affects folks besides Trump, right? You know, so the expansion of that to a broader foreign influence industry is interesting. Before launching that, he was deputy director of the National Security Program at Third Way. Prior to that, Ben was a National Security Fellow at the Project on Government Oversight, POGO, and that was 2011 to 13. And, you know, POGO does amazing work on revolving door. They kind of spun out of CDI, Center for Defense Information, something that one of our other guests, Ben Cohen, has been like a big champion of and trying to recreate. And he's, you know, really, really supports the work of POGO. While he was there, you know, he spearheaded their creation, the creation of their foreign influence database, and a repository of kind of propaganda distributed by foreign agents. And that had been previously unavailable online or, you know, which is where people get their information. So, you know, very basic background. He got his PhD from Texas A&M. His dissertation looked at the ability of foreign governments to effectively lobby for economic and military assistance from the U.S., something that Henry and I have seen kind of in the breach to a certain extent. In fact, Henry, as a military policeman, is kind of the guy for military assistance on some level and security force assistance. And then upon graduation from A&M, he taught in the political science department at the Bush School of Government and Public Policy there at A&M. And he's written in a whole lot of places, in addition to his mega reports that are just wild, and I wish they would print in full, you know, in the New York Times. He writes shorter pieces that have been in the New York Times, Politico, CNN. He's testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee. This is somebody that you need to know, you need to follow on Twitter, and just check out. And I know it's going to be a great conversation. So now that I've flattered you more than you're comfortable with, Ben, thanks for coming on.
Danny, thanks so much for having me. I feel like I just want to have you follow me around and give that intro every time I speak somewhere.
I could be like your theme music, except professionally, you know. When I walk around, I feel like, depending on my mood, you know, Roxette's Dangerous plays, or if I'm sad, Roxette's It Must Have Been Love plays. But it would be better, I think, to have, you know, someone giving you like a professional, you know, plaudit as you walk around. So I'm in. I'm looking for work, and we'll talk about that offline, I think.
Sounds good. But in all seriousness, thank you for the great intro. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for coming. And you've kind of inspired me with your last reports, and we're going to talk about that as we go forward. I've sort of shamelessly plugged in, linked to them, and used it, particularly the think tank report that came out recently. But what we had like a Zoom call just to talk about some other projects and CIP and moving forward, and then just kind of, you know, social and discussing things. And on that Zoom, we were joking back and forth a whole bunch about the work we do, the beauty of it, the tragedy of it, you know, the difficulties and why we wouldn't have it any other way, and plenty of jokes about how if we wrote reports that were favorable to Raytheon, we'd probably have bigger houses and all this. But I think that even though it's kind of a cliche on podcasts and interviews to, you know, say, oh, tell us your journey, I'm a big believer in human interest, backstory, you know, how people get to where they are. And so, you know, if you could kind of just take us from, you know, womb to the not yet tomb, and kind of, and that is a Nas reference, kiddos. Okay, pay attention. You know, just tell us your story, basically, like how you got involved in this work, why you cared, and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, sure, happy to. It really begins kind of 20 years ago or so, where I frankly, it begins in a place where somebody who's, you know, now works in DC in this very political world has no business coming from. My mother literally sells seashells by the seashore. I'm not even joking. Her name's not Sally, but otherwise, I'm not joking. I'm from Florida, and my mom owns a shell shop, and that was kind of the family business growing up. So when I went to college, to get a business degree. But while I was in college, the tragic events of 9/11 happened, and then the Iraq War happened. I hadn't taken a political science class in my life, but somehow I just sort of knew deep down that the decision to invade Iraq was wrong, and I didn't quite know why. I come from a more conservative area of Florida, and so I was one of the only people I knew that really disagreed with that decision. You know, all my friends, of course, were saying, you don't know what you're talking about, shell guy, you know, go back to the gift shop, you know, shut up about politics. And, you know, being the nice Florida man that I am, I basically said, hold my beer and watch this. And then I went to grad school for 7 years and ended up getting a master's degree, and a PhD in political science. And I very much started my interest in that, you know, was very much sparked by the Iraq War. And a big part of what's ultimately led me to where I am now is understanding the foreign influence component of the Iraq War. And that, of course, is the Saudi lobby, and really kind of the genesis of the modern day lobby starts then. They hired on a firm called Qorvis Communications, which continues to be part of the Saudi lobby to this day, signed a multi-million dollar contract with them then, and they continue to make millions from the Saudis to this day. And after sort of digging up all that dirt on Qorvis and what was going on with the influence operation related to the Iraq War, I never really turned back from investigating foreign influence. As you mentioned, Danny, it's what I wrote my dissertation on at Texas A&M. And the good folks at POGO were kind enough to hire an ambitious academic nerd to do some more foreign influence work while I was there. Also did some good DOD oversight work there too. But I was able to sort of for the first time share kind of to a wider audience what I had been finding in this really like Wild West of foreign influence work. Because this was well before 2016, and I published my book before 2016 too. As I joked with Danny privately, nobody cared. Frankly, I'm still not sure if my mom and dad read it, because foreign influence just wasn't the issue then that it is now. But of course, then 2016 happens, and suddenly my phone's ringing off the hook, and everybody's very interested in this issue once again, and. So I viewed it very much as my, I had an obligation to share the insights that I had found, to share with other folks how to dig up information about what other foreign governments lobbyists were doing to try and steer U.S. foreign policy in pretty bad directions. And what I really do, I do much less of the, Russian interference type work. I call it the regular old mundane $500 million foreign lobbying industry. That's the work that I do and working to expose that and just explaining to people how influential that industry is in determining foreign policy. And it really doesn't even matter what foreign policy decision you're talking about, whether it's military assistance to a country, whether it's where we keep our bases, which foreign countries, how many troops there, do we get in the Iran deal, do we get out of the Iran deal. Just about every single foreign policy decision the U.S. makes, there are some serious influences coming from lobbyists working on behalf of foreign governments.
You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland.
Well, I like how you refer to it as the normal, mundane, millions of dollars and influence of tragic in its consequences, U.S. policies. And it's funny how, you talked about the book that you write, your dissertation, your subject. You know, it's not in vogue, right, for the longest time. And then it is, right? It's interesting how subjects, one subject can be out of fashion until it's not. And while the Russian story really piqued everyone's interest, well, 60% of Americans or so, 51%, I don't know, of the voting Americans, because, Trump's a monster, and he is, and therefore he's, colluding or, quote unquote, with Putin directly and all this. And so suddenly it gets in the news and on the public consciousness, which isn't, in and of itself isn't necessarily a bad thing, because you've been pointing out how broad this is in the first place. And I just wanted to ask you about 2001 and 2003, timing wise. You mentioned how that was so influential to you and how you kind of looked into the foreign aspect of that, which I think has not been looked into enough. A lot of folks would say that, there's really two ways to respond to 9/11 and especially to the Iraq invasion, right? There's only two ways that matter. And it seems like that would be in the common imagination. You either join the military and, ruck up and go fight, or you get in the streets, with Code Pink or whomever, right? Many of which I, collaborate with and enjoy, and fight this thing from the outset. And while I'm sure that I don't know to the extent which you've done some of the latter, you kind of pick this other path that doesn't get spoken about, which is, look, someone's got to do the real work of finding facts and offering the justification for policy or protest. And so I was just wondering if you could talk a little about, career choice in terms of like inflection and the nature of it and what you think the value of that is.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And thinking back to that time for me, I was in college. And so just sort of going to college and observing that. And I think my gut reaction was, it was the first one you said, was that, we got attacked. I should join the military to fight back and defend us. But then what I saw about the decisions that we were making, and that why I was giving that some very serious thought as soon as I left college, that I would do that. But then what I started to see was there were no shortage of the Ben Freemans of the world joining the military. Like, that wasn't the problem. Like, at least the way I saw it, it wasn't a problem of a shortage of people, a shortage of good people joining the military. The problem was a military leadership that would lead us, frankly, astray from Afghanistan and hunting down Osama bin Laden to start a war that we had no business starting. And so then, that's what sort of led me to, look down these other paths, what could possibly lead us to make such a foolish foreign policy choice? I of course ultimately gravitated towards the foreign lobbying element of it that led us to it, and spent a good bit of time documenting that, and I've never really stopped looking at the Saudi lobby. In fact, just this very morning, I was looking up information on the Saudi lobby. So, you know, almost 20 years later, I'm still on the beat. And I think the reason why I do that, and the reason why I think that that's very important to do, I love you know Code Pink and Medea Benjamin and the folks who get in the streets. I think that's incredibly valuable. I just think for me, my unique contribution is, you know, I'm kind of a nerd. I'm good at connecting the dots. I'm good at following the money, and I'm really good at digging up the dirt that I think a lot of these, you know, war profiteers don't want dug up. So my value add in terms of stopping us or helping to prevent the next foolish war is doing what I do. It's identifying those foreign influence operations that are trying to lead the U.S. astray. And it's calling out some of the war profiteers, who, of course, they're engaging in lobbying and domestic influence campaigns of their own, whether it's from, you know, hiring lobbying firms themselves or, you know, investing in think tanks or other forms of influence. That there's a huge war profiteering industry that I think we need more people, frankly, to call out everything that they're doing to try and drive the U.S. to more foreign wars.
You know, one last point on that before we kind of move on to some more detail. We had Ali Soufan on the pod maybe two or three guests ago, you know, that FBI anti-torture, mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda guy, you know, I mean, Al-Qaeda investigator, Lebanese American. And, you know, so in prepping for that, I think me and Henry both like re-looked at the Looming Tower book, the Looming Tower Hulu series, and, you know, other stuff that he's done in either nonfiction or fiction. And one of the things that jumps out in some of his narrative, and definitely in the fictional representations or the, you know, fictional representations of the truth, is right after 9/11, this like immediate day of pivot to getting the Saudis out of the country a top priority. And, right. And so maybe, you know, in, you know, touching on that or not, or pivoting from that, you know, why Saudi Arabia? You know, like, I mean, it sounds so obvious to people who are in the know, but I think that the number of people that are in the know are not that high, especially, you know, among some of our listeners, but probably even more so widespread. Like you said, you're still working on the Saudi thing, and there's probably good reason for that. So, like, why Saudi Arabia? Why is this a problem in a very general sense?
You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, you know, when you're talking about 9/11, you have to, I think, start with the basic recognition that 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. You know, Osama bin Laden himself was a Saudi. So the impetus for this overwhelmingly comes from Saudi Arabia. And so I think the you know, if this were in a court of law, to me, it's almost like Saudi Arabia is going to have to convince me that they're not guilty. And so because all the evidence points to Saudi Arabia, you know, we know where these folks came from. So what happens next, I think, is even more jarring because of that, because you do have all these Saudi nationals that are flowing out of the country. And you do really, you have this very, very concerted campaign to get Saudi Arabia kind of off the hook for what happened. And they did, you know, if you look at some of the, you know, public opinion from back then, you know, Saudi Arabia does take a hit in terms of their, you know, America's preference for them. But 10 years later, most Americans have completely forgotten that the Saudis were actually, Saudi citizens at least, were actually responsible for 9/11. And I think a big part of that, in addition to the lobbying campaign, in addition to everything that the Saudi royals do to maintain favor in Washington, there were very strong economic interests for the U.S. to play nice with Saudi Arabia. And we said it a lot then, but it's, you know, it's the oil, frankly. you know, the U.S. wanted to keep relations going steady with Saudi Arabia, wanted to keep oil prices down, want to make sure that oil kept flowing. And so in many ways, they were really willing to bend over backwards for Saudi Arabia. And frankly, they haven't stopped. And you look at the Trump administration was the epitome of this. And just, you know, bending over backwards to do everything we could to cater to Saudi Arabia, from, you know, turning a blind eye to the war in Yemen, to increasing arms sales to Saudi Arabia, and just Trump going to Saudi Arabia and just really singing the praises of a regime that continues to be, you know, a gross human rights abuser, destabilizing the Middle East with the war in Yemen, Syria too, not to mention there. And of course, the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And then even with all that stuff, everything that the Saudis did, they really weren't punished. There really hasn't been any serious, reprisals from the U.S. to punish Saudi Arabia for what it's done. And I still think the reason I still focus on them is because that is by and large a product of their, frankly, highly successful influence operation that they're still running in America.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt that has always been the elephant in the room. And I mean, I remember reading, I was in the army, I may have been a cadet, you know, reading like House of Bush, House of Saud, you know, these books. And there was a moment where many in the foreign policy establishment, especially once there was kind of a pivot away from Bush, started to say things like, oh, it's too simplistic to say no blood for oil, you know, it's not all about oil. That's like such a surface level argument. But I think that what you're bringing into the analysis and what you just said is that, well, look, oil and energy and strategic location were always a prime factor. It's just that the way that that works isn't as clear cut, maybe, as, you know, some folks say. But let us not forget that in fact, if you kind of, you know, scratch away the surface, you take a little sandpaper to the lingo, you know, that's what's there. And I think that that's right. Pretty important. So, Henry, take us through just, you know, your general questions on general foreign policy influence or foreign actor influence, because I think this goes so much deeper. And of course, the Saudis will keep coming up, but there's so much to it.
So one thing I noticed going through it, and you know, I try to look at base level stuff, partly because I don't have the brain space that Danny does, but that we are, you know, it's so easy to miss the simplicity of certain things. And so my question for you, Ben, is, it I saw mentioned about contributions or connections to the office of the U.S. Secretary of Defense. And could you talk us through that a little bit about, like, what kind of stuff does the SecDef's office need lobbying for, need these connections, need these kind of strings to pull on?
Oh, it's a great, great question. I rarely get to talk about this. I'm glad you asked it. But I think everybody asks, well, I always get asked, well, you know, who's the most influential lobby? You know, who gets it done the best for them? You know, is it, you know, is it the Saudis or is it Israel? Is it somebody else? And I often will stop them in their tracks and I'll say, no, it's the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense is by far the best lobbying firm in Washington, D.C. And the reason for that, in particularly the Office of the Secretary of Defense, in the chiefs of all the services, they're just incredibly adept at working the Hill to get the budgets that they want. And for them, I think the results speak for themselves. If you look at the DOD budget, despite, I think, what some of my friends at the Heritage Foundation might say, the DOD budget right now is near historic highs. And in fact, the historic highs were towards the beginning of the Obama administration, you know, 2010, 2011 were historical highs. But we're close to that still. And yet people are still crying about the DoD budget being low. And a big part of that is that the Secretary of Defense and all those folks, you know, policy folks over there, they spend a good bit of time working the Hill, you know, having meetings with folks on the Hill. And it's very, we could have a whole another podcast on, and I'd be very curious to hear both of your thoughts on the civilian military divide right now. And the problem that I see is that I don't really think that Congress is holding up its end of the bargain on congressional oversight of the military. My experience and seeing folks on the Hill is that if a general says it, they will roll over and believe it, hands down. Even if it's, you know, something just as ridiculous as the F-35 is perfectly fine and it's not wasting any money. You know, a general says that, a member of Congress says, well, okay, you know, I guess I got to believe you that one of the worst, you know, the biggest waste of money in military acquisition history, you know, it's perfectly fine. But there's just this level of trust right now. It's beyond trust. It's sort of blindly believing anything that's told to them by a military officer. And I think Congress has a duty. They literally have, you know, a constitutional oversight role. And I really think when it comes to DOD right now, that they are blowing that oversight role.
Because looking through the report, you know, there's sections for the Air Force and there's sections for the Army and the Marine Corps, but we don't think of DOD as being a beast unto itself, that it can do some of its own things separate from the branches, and that if you didn't know to ask about that, you just wouldn't hear about it. The other one I found, and this wasn't surprising to me, was the Department of Homeland Security. How big of a slice of pie that has in terms of the lobbying. You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland. So will you talk to us a little bit about the nature of funding in terms of that it's all voluntary, that what we find out from these institutions is what they choose to tell us, not what the law says they're required to provide. And then I'm sure that goes to your congressional oversight as well.
Sure. Yeah. The Homeland Security funding was absolutely interesting. And to be clear about that funding, the funding they were talking about is going to the think tanks in a big chunk of that Homeland Security money. Was going to the RAND Corporation. And I imagine a lot of your listeners are familiar with RAND, but for those who aren't, the RAND Corporation is effectively, it's kind of colloquially called the DOD's think tank. This is a place where folks in the DOD can go to, and it's many parts, many parts of it are these federally funded research centers that are in some cases exclusively funded by the DOD, and they're designed to sort of be like kind of like the brainiacs for DOD, where DOD can go to, can pay them some money to do these studies on just about anything under the sun, you know, climate change or, you know, Arctic security issues, you name it. And RAND's done a study on it. And they're good studies. I find little fault with the studies that RAND conducts, whether it's for DOD or whether it's for the Department of Homeland Security. They're good. They're good objective researchers, I think. But at the end of the day, there's a sort of selection bias coming in about which studies that they'll do. In other words, DOD is only going to pay for certain kinds of studies. And so even if the work itself is, you know, purely objective and it's good, it's unbiased, there's a built-in bias in that you know, us peaceniks, we already mentioned Code Pink earlier, Medea Benjamin is not funding too many RAND studies. I don't imagine, I would be surprised if she's ever funded a single RAND study. So there's this inherent bias built in where you're not having, you know, pacifists that are funding studies or that are driving the research agenda for these think tanks, and RAND's the epitome of it. But some of the other think tanks are right in there too. You know, whether it's, you know, some of the ones that got less funding than RAND did, you know, the Center for New American Security, or CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, they both got millions of dollars too from the U.S. government and defense contractors. And you see a similar bias in the work that they're doing too. You know, it's very heavily DOD focused, and particularly for those two think tanks, you can see that some of the work, just at least to me, seems to, you know, be very biased towards a more militarized U.S. foreign policy and more defense spending.
So the idea that that any kind of non-offensive action, those kind of studies, they simply wouldn't show up.
That's exactly right. Yeah, you just don't see those studies about the value of what if we didn't go to war, or what if we didn't increase, what if there was a way to reduce the threat of China, what would the economic benefits be of that, or how much money could we save if we didn't keep raising tensions with Iran? You don't see these studies of these trade-offs for these alternative, more peaceful paths. Those studies just aren't being done, or they're certainly not being done by a lot of these think tanks. You get some of those from outside of it, by organizations like the Brown, the Cost of War Project, of course, is a great example of this. But having studies that show you the value of peace are incredibly rare, because the war profiteers are funding most of these studies.
And Ben, you know, you're on staff at CIP. I'm a senior fellow there. You probably have, more knowledge of the internal kind of workings of CIP. But I noticed in, one of the next reports we're going to talk about, my favorite, right, or recent favorite on the think tank funding, you looked into the top 50 think tanks, right? What's considered by a number of different measures the top 50 think tanks in America. I noticed that are think tank, right? CIP wasn't on that list. And so I was wondering, maybe you could kind of just, as a way of transition, talk about how, like, yes, you're in the think tank world, but what are the differences in terms of funding source? You don't have to get into a ton of detail, but what are the differences in funding source for a place like CIP versus a place like RAND, or the two favorites, the archetypal favorites, in fact, of the Biden transition team, for example, which, as you mentioned, the two tanks of CNAS and CSIS. So, what's the difference, and I guess the obvious, what's the implication of that?
Yeah, it's a great question, and there's so many differences, and it really, really does start. One takeaway I hope folks have from the think tank funding report is that funding matters, and it in many ways, the funding a think tank gets can drive that think tank's work. It can drive that think tank's conclusions of its work. And in that, its work is designed to influence U.S. foreign policy, or U.S. domestic policy, and depending on the think tank, too. And so what we see with comparing a place like CIP to, think tanks like that, CIP right off the bat doesn't accept corporate money, no corporate money whatsoever. And so forget defense contractor money. CIP doesn't take money from Google, Microsoft, none of the tech companies, none of the big oil and gas companies, no big Wall Street firms, no lobbying firms for that matter. None of that. The Fortune 500, is off our radar. It's just not a funding source that we will accept money from. We also, my program specifically, will not take any foreign government money. And in fact, CIP only has one foreign government donor, and that's the government of Norway, who gives some money to a CIP program called Mighty Earth to do some environmental work. And other than that, CIP doesn't get any foreign government money either. And as I found out in two different reports this year, if you take out both of those sources of money, foreign government funding and U.S. government and defense contractor funding, those businesses, well, that's over $1 billion in funding. It's around $1.2 billion in funding that you're eliminated in the past 6 years. So what that then means for CIP is that CIP remains small. You know, we're a small think tank. I mean, especially compared to places like CNAS and CSIS, they dwarf us in size. And a big part of that is because they have such a larger funding base that they can pull from. But then that's where I think, at least I guess I'm biased, being a CIP fellow, I think that's where their advantage ends. Because, you know, with that funding, there come strings attached. And now they would debate me about, you know, how extensive those strings are, that sort of thing. Sure. And you know, all the think tanks that we talk to, they claim to have rigorous conflict of interest policies. Sure, that's all well and good. But my challenge would be to them is to keep writing reports that are critical of one of your funders and then see how long they keep funding you. And the answer is not long. And we've seen this with think tanks before, and it's very obvious how the system works. So the advantage for a place like CIP then, for folks like Danny and I, is, big disadvantage right off the bat, we don't have their salaries. You know, we don't have these nice big houses and, you know, fancy cars that they do and everything. But we have a huge advantage in our research, is that we don't have to cater to some foreign government's interests. We don't have to do the whims of a defense contractor. And we can say things that are critical about the U.S. government, too, because we're not relying on them for funding either. And so it really provides us with a level of intellectual freedom and intellectual objectivity that the folks at these other think tanks just don't have. And at the end of the day, for Danny and I know we're for the both of us, we can sleep well at night knowing that the work we do, you know, we're not doing at the behest of some big corporation or some foreign power. We're doing the work we do because we think it's right.
You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland.
So let's, and it's true, you know, we talked about that the other day on our call, like, you know, there's no talk about self-righteous, classic self-righteous Danny, you know, but there is this notion that there isn't a price on looking yourself in the mirror. Can't put a price on that. But also, even just in the practical sense, I mean, I've found, and I imagine you have too, that there's solace and there's benefit personally to the, you know, independence of, like, knowing that you don't have to couch everything you write and everything you say, even if it's indirectly through concern that, man, you know, maybe this is going to upset the bosses because they may not say it, but the bosses are, you know, linked to these folks, not just financially, but maybe like professionally, socially, cocktail party wise, you know, as Kelly Blahos wrote about, like, the people who were putting together the surge in Afghanistan, many of whom are about to re-enter the administration. She talked about going to a party, a cocktail party of, like, generals and these civilian national security officials, and she referred to the women as hawks who were in smart skirts, you know. But, you know, I love that line, and Scott Horton quotes it all the time. But, you know, there's something to that, and I think what you're talking about here is that there are direct and there are indirect ramifications to that funding. It's a delusion to think that you know, these groups stay completely independent. And yet, when I was, you know, doing my research building on yours, I mean, you note that, you know, whether it's the Atlantic Council or CSIS or CNAS or Brookings, I mean, there's always a note. And I think you've probably, and I think you've said you've sort of received things like this from their public affairs officials, but, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, that, like, regardless of funding, like, we are completely, like, scholarly and independent. And it's almost like the lady doth protest too much a bit. And I think this is interesting. So I guess pivoting now, I mean, your report is, and we're going to link to it, you know, your report is just unflinching in its statistics, in its evidence. I mean, it's so careful about making sure that everything's right. I mean, you tack towards the side of caution and the low estimates and all this. And I love that, right? I'm a researcher too. I mean, it's like my favorite thing to do is go on like a Wikipedia spiral, but with real sources, which is how people like you and I end up in this work. But what, you know, in practice, and you do a little of this in the report, and I know you've done it in articles, in practice, you know, whether anecdotally or generally, what does this look like? What does the influence look like? How does it affect the bottom line of policy, and what is done in the name, whether we know it or think about it or not, in the name of the American people?
Yeah, the thing about the funding and going through and looking at all of it, and then and that's really where we started with this report and in the preceding the prequel, I guess, on foreign funding of think tanks, was a very similar approach. We started by saying we just want to get the money. We want to for the first time we want to add up all this money, and we want to get it from all the sources we can, and that included me sending some pretty nice emails, I thought, to these think tanks, and, you know, asking them if the information we had was correct, and if, you know, they had more information to provide, and, you know, getting confirmation of all this stuff. And it might surprise folks today. I did have some, you know, pretty good conversations with some folks at think tanks, you know, about their funding and about these issues too, to sort of get their side of the story. But we really started, we wanted to know that we had the best available data out there on these top 50 think tanks. And I feel very confident that we did. And I feel very confident because in the case of both reports, I got from communications directors at those think tanks who were angry emails that said, you know, you claim in your report that we get funding from, you know, XYZ country or this defense contractor or that, you know, we don't have any records of that. You know, where are you pulling this information from? And then I send back a very polite email that says, well, you know, here's our source from it. And that source is your website or it's in your own annual report. It's on page, you know, 43, and, you know, here's the exact digits that we found. So we, in many cases, we were able to provide these think tanks with, I think, even more transparency than they knew they had. So starting it from that point to us was incredibly important, because then we could do what was actually my favorite part about it, is trying to connect the dots with this. So once we had the funding, then we went back and took a real hard look at what did these think tanks do? What did they do that was, you know, related to some of these funders? What did they put out that might have been of interest to them? And almost to a think tank, we found that we always found evidence of reports that seemed, you know, overwhelmingly to side with the funders' interests. And, you know, whether that was, you know, recommending arms sales to a foreign government that had funded them, or whether that was recommending buying more of a weapon that a defense contractor who funds them manufactures. We found some very, very clear linkages, we thought, or, you know, you can call them coincidental, whatever you want. But to us, it seemed very clear that the thrust of the reports coming out of think tanks does appear to be very much in line with the funding that those think tanks are getting. And this is true. We put out a series of op-eds, and I know you have too, Danny, on everything from the ICBM lobby, ICBM manufacturers, and, you know, the nuclear modernization. You know, a lot of the think tanks that are advocating for that, you know, they're funded by the exact same defense contractors that are going to benefit from it. When it comes to arms sales to foreign countries, if you see a think tank really out there advocating for it, chances are they're getting some funding from that very government that's going to be the recipient of that arms sale. So to go back to my very opening comments, it really doesn't matter what the foreign policy issue is. Chances are there is funding behind it that's driving that U.S. foreign policy in that direction. And that may have nothing to do with whatever the U.S. national security interest is. This is purely in the interest of those paymasters.
So I think this is important. And one of the things that struck me about the think tank report, especially as I read it sort of repeatedly, actually, was that, you know, there's a real connection between foreign influence and defense contractor influence and U.S. government influence on these issues. And I think you really raised that very well in this particular report, because they're not discrete, and most things rarely are discrete. And I started looking, largely motivated by this report, which really just was perfectly timed. I mean, I don't know if you had some sort of like insider knowledge, you know, or any of that, but I mean, it's unbelievable, because as this team gets announced, you know, as this team gets announced from Biden, it's like you couldn't have built it any better, because the very think tanks that you're looking at, right? So CNAS and CSIS are the second and sixth, right? I believe from your report, the second and sixth highest recipients of U.S. government and defense contractor funding. And then, you know, I started digging into Michelle Flournoy, because, you know, I'm a little bit obsessed with the Biden bros and sisters coming in. And, you know, you find out in, you know, open source reporting from a number of different sources that, you know, the odds on favorite for Secretary of Defense was exchanging emails with like the UAE ambassador, pitching a project to, you know, write a report on whether the, you know, to the extent to which the U.S. should follow the non-binding multilateral kind of control agreement on drones and missile technology. And then, of course, wouldn't you know, CNAS receives his $250,000 on the report that argues for amending the agreement to allow, you know, the UAE to buy these drones. And then, of course, the Trump administration, which is supposedly the sworn enemy of Flournoy and company, you know, does this very thing. And so what struck me about that was like, wow, you know, there is such a connection between the general work that your initiative does, that you've spent so much time on, you know, in terms of scholarship and public advocacy in your career, and then the funding report. And so maybe you could dig in a little more on that aspect of the nexus between the two, the inextricable link.
You are listening to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think that this is where it really gets from kind of 2D muckraking to 3D chess, where we're trying to get to the heart of all these different influences. And you know, there's all these avenues for influence, right? Whether there's lobbying firms, you know, I think think tanks are another key part of it. We haven't even talked about higher education now, and foreign governments are spending billions of dollars at U.S. colleges and universities too, trying to garner influence there. That's a whole other can of worms. And then we have you have these great nexuses between the weapons manufacturers that are making weapons that they of course want to and do sell to foreign governments. And we've seen this with the Saudis previously, and very recently with the United Arab Emirates. We know all of the weapons manufacturers that are going to be part of this deal. And so, you know, it's the F-35, it's drones. The folks that are making these weapons, you know, we know they're lobbying for this arms sale. But guess who else is too? The United Arab Emirates and the UAE has one of the most powerful and influential foreign lobbies in the U.S. And so when you combine all that firepower, if I remember right, last year, the UAE spent almost $20 million on lobbying and PR firms registered under the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Combine that with an arms industry who's spending similar amounts of money too, and you sort of get this, you know, weapons spreading transformer of influence that becomes really, really hard to stop. And I think we're seeing it now with this UAE arms sale, and you know, I think the progressive community is putting up a good fight against this arms sale. But it's really, again, it's David versus Goliath. They have, you know, armies of lobbyists, and we just don't have the numbers to go up against them. But I think hopefully on this, we're at a point, at least on this specific deal, where most members of Congress like sort of get it, how this could be really dangerous to give the United Arab Emirates F-35s and armed drones. They've seen what the UAE did in Yemen, and you know, they see what the UAE does at home, frankly, with the human rights issues there. So I think, you know, hoping maybe there's enough members of Congress there that can push back on this trifecta of kind of war profiteering, you know, weapons building influence. But it's emblematic of the industry as a whole. There's all these connections and these nexuses that bring together these individually hugely powerful lobbying firms, and then they combine forces to push these initiatives through, and they can become incredibly hard to stop because of it. But on the flip side of that, for me, these are the most fun because, you know, I can track all of these different influences. So it's just a matter of, you know, connecting all the dots here and identifying all these influences, and trying to call folks out when they're engaging in some of this behavior that, well, they probably shouldn't be, or at the very least, I really don't think it's in the interest of America to have the United Arab Emirates with armed drones anytime soon. And I'll just say, Danny, one note on top of that, the Michelle Flournoy thing, I had been following her since her time at CNAS, and you know, she's I really just want to push back real quickly on folks who think like we shouldn't be critical of some of the Biden administration. And I think I first and foremost, I'm a progressive, and so, you know, I'm much, much happier to see Biden and very qualified Biden folks coming in. I'm very happy to see them coming in versus the Trump administration, which I think was awful for many, many reasons. But at the same time, I don't think it serves anyone if we just unflinchingly accept any nominee just because they're a Biden nominee. I think it's very important for folks to take a long, hard look at these folks' qualifications. And many of them are very, very qualified, too. But I think we have every right to call out their connections with the arms industry, and we have every right to call out their connections with foreign governments. And Michelle Flournoy was at the perfect nexus of this to me, because while she was at CNAS, she accepted $250,000. CNAS did accepted $250,000 to write this study that was about drones. And of course, the study comes out and it says, you know, recommends, among other things, to give the UAE armed drones. And then going forward, of course, we've seen these past few months, the UAE is now looks to be on track to get those armed drones. And so I think we have a right to be critical of Michelle Flournoy for at least in some way kind of being one of the original advocates for that deal and in helping to pave the way for the UAE to get to the point where they could even be lobbying for a deal like this. And so, you know, whether that means Michelle Flournoy should or should not be Secretary of Defense, I don't know. That's a decision for somebody else. But as for me, Ben Freeman, you can sure as heck bet I'm going to tell people at least about her connections with that foreign government. And I did the exact same thing with the Trump administration, and I'll do it throughout the Biden administration too.
Yeah, I think that you raise a really important point about when is critique, when is a critical eye appropriate, and I think the answer is almost always right? I mean, if you're going to be intellectually and ethically consistent, then it's important to raise questions. And the qualification point, you know, is something that I can get a little radical on. And so, you know, I'll often say that, you know, these folks are eminently qualified. Only I reject the cult of qualification, or I reject the terms of the qualification cult's game. You know, in other words, like I'm concerned, and this is personal opinion, I'm interested in your thoughts on it. I'm concerned by the notion that previous complicity and some often largely nefarious actions, even if they are, you know, a gradation below certain Bush ones, some Trump ones, or most Bush ones, some Trump ones, even if they're preferable in a comparative sense when we talk lesser evils, the idea that there aren't other qualified, if we change the terms of that discussion, that there aren't other qualified figures who could serve in the National Security Council as Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, who don't have this this taint, right? And the sad truth is maybe there really aren't that many. Maybe this game that you've been describing, this one that you've been unearthing, this one that you've been doing just unflinching research on, is so established that it is actually difficult to find, quote, qualified people that aren't tainted, that don't carry some of this with them. But I'd be interested in your thoughts, you know, as kind of a last point on this issue with the transition on, you know, do you think that we frame it in such a way, and I guess this is a leading question, but I mean, I really want to know what you think. Do you think that we frame who is a viable candidate in such a way that it maybe, you know, reduces the numbers available or kind of cuts other folks out of the game?
If you'd like to hear the rest of this episode, please visit our website at www.fortressonahill.com, or you can find us wherever you get your podcasts.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Salem Progressive Film Series presentation of Holding the Thin Green Line. This documentary slideshow tells the stories of people fighting to save the souls of their communities and